Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
About those pictures from Ferguson, Missouri that you have surely seen, among the many, many questions is this one. Where do local police get those kinds of weapons? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, the 14th of August. Everybody, good as always to have you with us. Both President Obama and the governor of Missouri, Jay Nixon, stepped before the microphones today to offer their thoughts on the events in Ferguson, Missouri. 5 days after the shooting of Michael Brown, protests have been growing, and the police have been using what looks a whole lot like sophisticated military-style gear. In fact, Governor Nixon said today that Ferguson, and this is a quote, looked a little bit more like a war zone, and it's not acceptable, he said. A lot of police departments across the country have that kind of equipment, thanks in no small part to the federal government. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
The Pentagon has what it calls a disposition services department. Its mandate, quite simply, is to dispose of stuff, to get rid of it. Night vision goggles, combat uniforms,
tear gas, grenades, M16s.
Robert Kane heads the Department of Criminology and Justice Studies at Drexel University. He says the Defense Department has sold billions of dollars of equipment at bargain basement prices.
You know, an armored personnel carrier can cost somewhere on the lines of, say, $780,000 or maybe even $800,000. And sometimes the police department can get that for $3,000.
There are also grants available. State and local police departments have dealt with the DOD for decades, but Congress formalized that relationship in the 1990s during the war on drugs and after the Los Angeles riots. Jim Pascoe is the executive director of the Fraternal Order of Police.
Law enforcement was, in many instances, outgunned and out-equipped from a technical standpoint.
After 9/11, departments acquired new surveillance equipment, along with new vehicles and weapons. David Harris is a law professor at the University of Pittsburgh who studies policing. He worries some departments rely on these high-end tools more and more.
You got the stuff. Isn't this the occasion to use it, goes the thinking.
To break up protests, to deliver warrants.
When you militarize the equipment and you militarize the personnel, you're also militarizing the situation, and that can lead to escalation.
Harris says police need the best training, the most suitable weapons, but departments need to consider carefully how and when they use them. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
In Denver, Colorado today, the country's biggest retailer is courting smaller ones. Walmart has invited dozens of small and medium-sized companies to get together to talk economic development and, in the process, how they might be able to produce their goods here and then sell them to Walmart. A contract with Walmart, of course, could mean a huge bump in sales for those companies, but with great opportunity often comes great risk. Sally Herships has more.
Scoring a contract with Walmart, for some companies, that can seem like hitting the lottery.
They have been just the best and finest people to deal with.
Mark Goldstein is CEO of Scott's Liquid Gold. It's a medium-sized company which expects to make almost $30 million in revenue this year. It sells just under a third of its products, like air fresheners, to Walmart.
They help companies like us to be more efficient in our manufacturing and our transportation.
But not all companies feel so affectionate about Walmart.
Working with Walmart can be a great experience, but it's very, very difficult.
Victor Lund is a business consultant, but he used to own Wow, a small company which sold cookie cutters to Walmart. He says no matter how small you are, if you want to work with Walmart, you have to follow the same requirements that Fortune 100 companies do.
They have a vendor booklet that talks about what their requirements are that was 8 inches thick.
Lund says Wow was really small. It had fewer than 20 employees and brought in less than $5 million of revenue a year, which made dealing with Walmart challenging.
Making sure that you're working with a manufacturer in China that's going to support you in being compliant with Walmart's rules and regulations is very, very important. but it also drives up costs tremendously.
And for some companies, working with Walmart is just too difficult. In Lund's case, WOW's vendor agreement with Walmart became more valuable than the company itself. So he sold it. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, another day, another dollar. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The macroeconomic story today, and I'm talking really macro here, as in the global economy, is Europe. Europe and a big fat goose egg. The economy in the 18 countries that use the euro was flat in the second quarter, 0.0% growth. Even the big ones, Germany and France, are slumping. Steve Evans is the Berlin correspondent for the BBC. Steve, welcome to the program.
Pleased to talk to you.
I wonder whether we all should have seen this slowdown coming. It's been a sketchy, year or so over in Europe.
Well, people in America have been warning the Europeans. People in America have been saying, look, you know, you need to do more to get your economy going, like our economy is going. But Angela Merkel, with her deep austerity policy, has said, no, you get the reforms in places like Greece and Spain going first, and then everything will come good. But what we're finding is the slowdown in the rest of Europe is so serious that it's now pulling Germany back, if you like. The engine's being pulled back by the burden.
What's the mood, though? I mean, are people believing these numbers and that it's really bad, much as we had a bad first quarter here in the States? Or is it more, it's just a data glitch and we'll be all right?
I think it's somewhere in between the two. People don't think it's a glitch. They think it's real. There is a real slowdown going on in Germany. But they don't think it's a turning of the corner. They don't think the thing is about to reverse. But on top of that, you can't doubt that there are real factors there. Germany exports 70% of its exports go to Europe. We talk about China, but it's Europe's the big customer. So slowdown in Europe, bad for Germany. On top of that, there is what some economists here are starting to call the Putin factor.
Yeah.
And that is German business thinks that sanctions against Russia are going to backfire. They don't like them at all. Germany was the first into Russia in all kinds of ways. Volkswagen, Adidas. That means they get their fingers burnt now.
Where will stimulus come from? Is the European Central Bank going to cut rates further and then plow more money into the equation? Do the quantitative easing that the Fed has done here? Is our governments going to come and do it? Who's going to do it?
You get the sense that the European Central Bank recognizes the problem. The issue then is, I don't see any sign at all of a change of economic policy, either from Chancellor Merkel or from her economics right-hand man, Wolfgang Schäuble. They are completely wedded to the view that the way you get this thing right is by being tight on spending in countries like Spain and Greece, and then things will come right.
But that's not what's happening, is it, right? I mean, Spain and Greece are doing relatively better than the core European economies.
It's absolutely not what's happening. It's flatlining. There's zero growth. But there is no popular clamor. The ordinary people are not shouting, change direction, get spending. It's just not the way they think.
Steve Evans with the BBC in Berlin. Steve, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure.
You remember high school? Not the experience so much. Who needs that? But the actual physical building. Narrow hallways, dark classrooms, mostly, by and large, old feeling. Yeah, well, not anymore. After a big slowdown during the recession, spending on school construction, renovating old schools and building new ones is picking up. More than $13 billion last year alone. And those newer schools are being designed with the latest technologies and teaching models in mind. So from Learning Curve, our coverage of the intersection of education and technology, Marketplace's Adrian Hill gets a lesson in the school of the future.
At a rocket ship charter school in San Jose, workers put the finishing touches on the building. bright blue and purple and orange paint is still wet on classroom walls. The school design is clean, open.
This is a typical rocket ship classroom. It's about 640 square feet.
Laura Kozel is in charge of making sure these rooms are finished and less fumy in time for the kindergarten through fourth graders who pour in next week. She's VP of Facilities at Rocket Ship, a network of elementary charter schools where computers are a part of every kid's day. Light floods the classroom.
We incorporated skylights into the building that weren't here before.
Throughout the school, there are small private breakout spaces where kids can work with teachers or each other. And at the center of it all is a wide open computer lab, the size of four classrooms with polished concrete floors. It'll soon be full of 160 kids, each on their own laptop, working on their own lessons.
Individualized instruction for students is the right way to go. I think you have to meet every child where they're at, and that's really what our model is designed to do.
Kids learning on cutting-edge technology raises two important questions. The first, how will a fragile computer ever survive a year with a kindergartner and a concrete floor? And second, how do you design a school that won't be obsolete in 20 years when no one has any idea what tech or teaching might look like in five?
If we do a good job, it's to give the teacher something that is really going to be adaptable to however they want to teach.
That's architect Michael Pinto from NAC Architecture, a firm that specializes in school design.
The challenge is to both be specific to the things they want to do, but also preserve some generality, some flexibility, that agility that adapts to new technologies, new philosophies of learning.
In other words, the school of the future is a school that knows how to get out of the way. Pinto shows me just such a place, Playa Vista Elementary School in Los Angeles. No, there are no docks to park your jetpack or cubbies for Google Glasses. The three-year-old school is characterized instead by movable partitions, open spaces, and furniture that doesn't screech across the floor when you rearrange it. Teacher Rachel Henry calls her classroom amoebic.
I'm a firm believer that children need change and they can get bored easily just with their physical environment. Yeah.
Spaces are built to transform into other spaces, again in the simplest of ways. Pinto made the outside walkways wider, so voila, they can be learning spaces. There's a bridge over the courtyard, intended for dropping things over the side. In schools of the future, kids still wrap eggs in paper and cardboard and hope for the best. All the flexibility is meant to encourage a new type of learning. Learning by doing. Learning with new technology. Learning that is collaborative, personalized. Learning that architect Prakash Nair says more traditional schools are no good at.
Kids are in a cell called a classroom for a certain period of time. A bell goes off. And then they go to another fairly identical cell.
Nair says we have $2 trillion worth of cells and bells type school facilities around the country.
If you look at the research about how we learn, it has absolutely nothing to do with being trapped in a room with people of identical age.
Schools with open, flexible space
cost less money than traditional schools that we are building.
Old school schools, he says, only use about 2/3 of their space for learning. Innovative designs, he says, use as much as 85% of the space. The Rocket Ship School in San Jose cost about $10 million to build, compared to about $16 million for a traditional elementary school. Teachers and architects around the country are working toward the same goal, to be prepared for the stream of kids headed their way in a few days and a few decades from now. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
We've got pictures of those schools of the future on our website, marketplace.org/learning curve. Coming up.
Anytime somebody gets in touch with me who's not here already, I'll always ask them, do you have housing right now?
Help wanted, housing required. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials popped up 61 points today, a third of 1%, closed at 16,714. The NASDAQ jumped 18 points, 0.4%, ended things at 44.53, while the S&P 500 put on 8 points, 0.4%, ended things at 1955. We talked about Walmart earlier in the broadcast. The company lowered its forecast for coming quarters today, but its share still rose 0.4%. General Electric ticked up 0.2% on news it might sell its household appliance division to Electrolux or Quirky. That's an actual company name, Quirky. Rival Whirlpool, by the by, spun up nearly 3% today. Red Robin Gourmet Burgers flopped 18% after the company reported quarterly earnings and revenue sharply below expectations. Bond prices rose. When that happens, the yield goes down, and thus it did. The 10-year T-note, 2.4% is the yield. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department issues a producer price index for July. A federal summit on the prevention of bullying takes place in Washington. Cyberbullying is one item on the agenda. And tomorrow is National Relaxation Day. Write that on a Post-it and stick it to your monitor. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Porsche is one of the all-time great car companies with a long and storied history. It's also got a big, big problem. 85% of the people who buy its cars are men. So after 3 years of research and development, Porsche has rolled out a new model specifically designed to appeal to women. Kyle Stock writes about the new car and its target audience in the latest issue of Bloomberg Businessweek. Kyle, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about this thing, the Macan. It is, you write in this piece, a car geared specifically for female Porsche potential owners.
Yeah, this is kind of a touchy thing in Porsche HQ. They say, you know, we only make Porsches. We don't make cars for women or for old men. But they do acknowledge that women it's a demographic that they haven't done great with, and they want new buyers, new customers for this. And so they're definitely thinking about that.
What does this thing look like?
Well, the Macan is an Indonesian word for tiger. So it's tallish, but not as tall as other SUVs. Mm-hmm. The hood is really kind of the piece de resistance. It's called a clamshell hood. So usually in the hood of a car, you'll see seams running from the top of the headlights up to the base of the windshield. You won't see that on these. The whole thing is pressed out in one piece of aluminum. So it actually runs over the side of the car.
Which is exactly the kind of thing that's designed to appeal to the Porsche purists who might be upset about this thing existing in the first place.
Exactly.
You have a great line in this piece about the development of the Macan. You say its development was a journey from the Nürburgring test track, where they obviously test their things over in Germany, to the Whole Foods parking lot. They're going after the soccer moms and the upper middle class people with disposable income who want a zippy little car.
They are, exactly. U.S. is their biggest market. China is their biggest market for SUVs, but it's very close. So those two areas are what they're looking at.
Is it working, do you think? Is it going to work?
I think it is going to work. Honestly, they're a little late to the party on this. The small SUV segment, the crossover segment, is by far the hottest segment in the market right now. And there's no signs of that slowing down. People love the size and shape of these things. In terms of luxury car sales, those are hot as well. So I think the only danger is that it takes some Cayenne buyers, some folks that otherwise might have bought the larger car. But then in the long run, maybe it makes some Cayenne buyers, you know, as people have a couple more kids, need something bigger, right, maybe they trade up.
Yeah, so they trade up. A word here about Volkswagen, the parent company.
Yes.
They are profiting wildly, it should probably be said, from Porsche.
They are. The companies have always been close. So the first Volkswagen Beetle was actually designed by the patriarch of Porsche. So they've always had a close relationship, but since Volkswagen became majority owner, Porsche is by far its most valuable brand, and this is a company that has a lot of brands, including Audi.
Yeah.
So 18% profit margin from Porsche, and that in the car industry, let alone at Volkswagen, is without peer.
Yeah. If Bloomberg Businessweek gives you a nice bonus, would you buy one of these for $70,000?
There's so many other things to buy, Kai. It's a heck of a car, I will say that. It was a sizable improvement over what I drive day to day.
Yeah, you and me both, pal.
Yeah.
Kyle Stock writes for Bloomberg Businessweek. Kyle, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Here's another car story, well, a car company story anyway. The German car maker Daimler is giving its employees a new vacation option. You know how when you go away, you set an out-of-office auto reply on your email, which is great, but you still have to spend time waiting through hundreds of old emails when you get back. Well, here comes the Daimler difference, if you will. Not auto-reply, but auto-delete. Kate Davidson reports.
This summer, about 100,000 Daimler employees can choose to have their incoming email deleted while on vacation, like permanently obliterated. Inbox zero.
To bring good input into the company, you need also to rest and you need breaks.
Spokesman Oliver Wachowski says Daimler wants employees to return to work motivated.
With a fresh spirit and don't have to think about, oh my God, I have to read 576 emails.
Instead, those 576 emails disappear. Their senders get a cheery notice with an emergency contact and the sign-off, I appreciate your understanding, exclamation point. Now, Daimler also has a plant in Tuscaloosa, but Wharton Management Professor Peter Capelli says auto-delete would be hard to pull off in America with its always-on mentality.
I would do it, but that's partly because not very many people actually need to talk to me.
But if you're a company deleting email, you got to be sure your customers and vendors will actually write to that emergency contact so you don't lose business.
Maybe it has to change the way they work, but it's tricky to change the way you work for one out of your 100 clients.
David Baggett created an app called Inky that helps manage email, not delete it. He says if you delegate from one human to another,
then you still have a scaling issue. You still have another person that has to scale to 1,000 messages a day, potentially.
Still, Daimler is forging ahead. The company piloted its mail-on-holiday program last year and says it doesn't monitor which employees use it. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
We're about to be in that in-between season for resort towns, winding down summer at the beach, too early for winter in the mountains. For business owners in both of those places, though, peak tourist season means they often need to hire more staff, double it sometimes. But the high cost of housing means the ski bums and college kids who often fill those jobs can't make ends meet. Wyoming Public Radio's Miles Bryan has that story.
It's mid-morning at a campsite just outside of Jackson, Wyoming, and Kristen Johnson is setting up her camp stove for a cup of coffee before work.
Came with the van.
Johnson works in town as a cocktail waitress, but her home is this old Econoline van. She says she's always looking for a place, but with a housing budget of $650 a month,
there's options that come up, but most of the time they're too expensive.
And even if Johnson found a place she could afford, there's no guarantee she could keep it.
I've had a lot of friends moved out of their places because the landlord wants to up rent now because there's such a high need.
Struggling to find a room is pretty common in Western resort towns like Jackson, Sun Valley, and Aspen. But lately, a stronger economy and the popularity of house-sharing sites like Airbnb have made finding a place almost impossible. That's created problems for local business owners like Chris Hansen.
Friday tends to be our busiest day of the week, year-round. This time of year, it's like that every day.
Hansen is the owner of Calderas, a little pizza joint right in the heart of Jackson. He came west as a ski bum after college in the 90s, and he says that when he's needed to grow his staff over the summer, he used to rely on college kids. But lately, that's been difficult.
Anytime somebody gets in touch with me who's not here already, I'll always tell them, or I'll ask them rather, do you have housing right now? And if the answer is no, then my answer is, well, come see me when you've got housing.
This summer, Hansen says he's hiring fewer kids from college and more kids from places like this.
Moldova, Republic of Moldova. It's a little tiny small country between Romania and Ukraine.
That's Nina Maiko, one of Chris Hansen's top servers this summer. To be fair, she's a college student, too. That's why she was able to qualify for the J-1 visa program, which brings international college students to the U.S. to work for a season. J-1 students' contracts almost always include housing. Good news for Maiko, who says she loves getting to work in the States, even if waiting tables here is a little different than in her home country.
There's like, you don't even introduce yourself. Hi, what do you like? Okay, bye. Shh, boom. Pack, pack, pack. You're done. Here, you kind of have a dialogue because it's in your interest, you know? Otherwise, you're not going to make money.
So we're seeing that the resorts, they love these students because they're very eager to come here.
Robin Lerner helps oversee the J-1 visa exchange program at the State Department. She says the reason you usually see Eastern Europeans when you're checking out at the grocery store or grabbing a drink is because their summer break generally aligns with ours. Lerner says the J-1 program is here to stay.
Any place where you have one season, is you're going to see such a need that it goes beyond what can be fulfilled through the local population.
Starts up like a champ.
Back at her campsite, Kristen Johnson is packed up and ready for work. She says that car camping is okay for now, but it isn't really a choice.
If I just decide I don't want to do it anymore, tough luck. You know, I don't really have another option other than leaving.
And Johnson says she might not come back next year. That would leave one really great summer job open, if you can find a place to stay. In Jackson, Wyoming, I'm Miles Bryan for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which, now that I think about it, might just have to be a new segment on this program. We'd call it Marketplace Reads Headlines That Make You Go, Wait, What? And then we would just read headlines, like this one, today, from the Wall Street Journal. Harvard scientists devise robot swarms that can work together. And then the subhead is, swarm of 1,024 tiny robots works together without guiding central intelligence. I'm telling you. I would listen. I think it's got potential, honestly. All right, we got to go. Today, the Dow up 61 points, a third of 1%. Of course, I would listen. The NASDAQ jumped 18 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 up 8 points, also 0.4%. John Buckley, Kim Bowie, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Cindy Johnston, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.